Psalm 135, verse 5, for I know that the Lord is great, and that our Lord is above all gods. Whatsoever the Lord pleased, that did he in heaven, and in earth, in the seas, and all deep places. He causeth the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth, maketh lightnings for the rain. He bringeth the wind out of his treasuries. Today we're going to look at water and the weather. Water is a miracle which we usually take for granted. The component parts of water are two gases, hydrogen and oxygen. Hydrogen is the most inflammable of gases, and oxygen is necessary for all fires, and yet combine the two and you have a tremendous fire extinguisher. Lower temperatures on fluids increase their weight. This is true of water also until the temperature gets within 4 degrees of freezing. And then the opposite happens. Instead of the specific gravity increasing, water becomes lighter and rises to the surface as ice is formed. It is imperative to our survival that it be that. If ice sank as soon as it formed, soon lakes and rivers in much of the world would be frozen solid. The result would be death to all their living inhabitants. Birds and animals that depend on the fish for food, as well as the lakes and rivers for water, would also be affected, because there would be insufficient time for thawing out in many regions. And because ice and snow, the more ice and snow you have, the more you have the sun's energy reflected, winter would become increasingly longer and progressively more severe. And eventually, because the balance of the seasons and the temperatures is so delicate already, you would have an ice age. So by changing an almost universal law, God removes from ice its potential death-dealing properties and causes it to act as a shield from the even colder air above the surface of the lake or river, thereby protecting the fish and the creatures that live therein. What a great God we serve. Water in great quantities is needed to sustain life everywhere in the world. No water, no life is the basic law of the universe. And yet in this area, as in so many other areas, there must be a precise amount. The acceptable parameters for sustaining life are very narrow indeed. There must be enough, but not too much. A mistake in either direction would be disastrous and fatal. So you have to assume that we just happen to get really lucky here on planet Earth, or that there is an all-wise creator God who knows what he's doing. Those really are your two choices. Now, if man were making a world, he would make it almost completely dry land. Oh, he'd stick a few pretty lakes and rivers here and there, and maybe an ocean or two, but it would be mostly dry land. If you or I were to design the world today without all of the background we have now in science, if we were to just design a world, we'd make it mostly dry land. Yet we find that there are 52 million square miles of land on this earth. There are 145 million square miles of water. Only 29% of the surface of the earth is dry land. 71% made up of oceans and rivers and lakes. Man wouldn't plan it that way. Yet scientists now agree that that is the right percentage. It must be that way. 50-50 wouldn't work. Even 60% water wouldn't work. We now know that the percentage that this world has is perfectly right for sustaining life. There's an area of scientific study which concerns itself with the weight and balance of the earth. That branch of science is known as isostasy. This did not come into full understanding by the scientists until the year 1959, just 35 years ago. We now know that the earth is perfectly balanced. There is equal weight to support landmass, valleys and plains and mountains and bodies of water. Our earth has incredible equilibrium. Waters in the oceans exert pressures upon the shore. That constant pushing is necessary, we now know, to keep the mountains up. By the way, water has been called a universal solvent, and yet the sandy seashores do not dissolve under the steady and relentless onslaught of the waves. Imagine if it was just earth that surrounded just regular soil that surrounded the oceans. It would steadily be eating away the land constantly, but God placed sand there and gave a perpetual decree to the ocean waves, as said in the Bible, "Hitherto shalt thou come and no further, and here shall thy proud waves be stayed." God said, "I'm going to give you a boundary, and that's as far as I'll allow you to go." The earth has different weights of mountains and ridges and soil and rock in different places to balance things out. And we know now that it's all done perfectly. Oh, for years we did not know that. But now we understand that through scientific study. The mountains and valleys and the ridges and the furrows and the hills and the hollows, all are necessary. If the earth were a round, even ball, the water would run at random over its surface, thus making life impossible. So there had to be tremendous excavations in the surface of the earth, deep enough and wide enough to hold the vast amounts of water necessary. And our oceans are vast reservoirs of life-giving liquid. The Bible talks of all these things, written thousands of years ago, and yet it is scientifically accurate today. If you doubt the inspiration of the Bible, if you question whether it's inspired by God this morning, if you wonder whether there even is a God this morning, pick up a science book written 100 years ago. Pick up a science book written 50 years ago and just start reading through it. And even if you're not trained in science and learned in science this morning, you can probably, even in that 50-year-old or 100-year-old science book, find things that you know are not true, that we now know are absolutely false. And yet those were written rather recently on the scale of time. And yet you pick up this book, and this book does not claim to be a science textbook. It was not written as that. But in every place it speaks of science, it speaks absolutely accurately. It was written thousands of years ago. Thousands of years ago this book was written, and yet scientifically it is accurate and up to date. If there is no God, if this book is not inspired, then how do you account for that? Isaiah chapter 40 and verse 12 says, "Who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hand?" Oh, it's not an accident. He's measured the waters in the hollow of his hand. He knew what he was doing. As he's meted out heaven with the span, and comprehended the dust of the earth in a measure, and we'll deal with that later, and weighed the mountains in scales and the hills in a balance. We didn't even know that was true till 35 years ago. And yet the Bible in Isaiah, written thousands of years ago, recorded that God measured it all out and God weighed it all out. And God did it precisely and exactly and correctly. Psalm 33:7 refers to the waters of the sea and says that God layeth up the depth in storehouses, speaking of the vast ocean reservoirs. Ecclesiastes 1:7 talks about the cycle of water. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. Unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again. It wasn't until the 16th century we begin to understand what the Bible had stated all along. Up until the 16th century, man used to believe in huge subterranean reservoirs with that inexhaustible supply of water. There was worry that eventually the oceans would fill up further and further and further, and lakes would fill up further and further, and eventually that would overwhelm cities and civilizations. But we know it's not true now. But the Bible all along has maintained that unto the place from whence the rivers come, thither they return again, and yet the oceans will never be full, never be overflowing. Bible deals with evaporation, precipitation, condensation, the whole water cycle. Since water runs downhill and all living things need water, divine creation was needed to bring about the water cycle. That's easy, you say, evaporation. But wait a minute. Seawater is 800 times heavier than air. 800 times heavier. So how do you evaporate that? Well, when seawater is vaporized by the sun's rays, the sun changes them instantly and noiselessly into molecules of watery vapor. And those water molecules now occupy 1,600 times the space that they formerly occupied before being energized by the sun's rays. They expand to 1,600 times the size they used to be. They become water vapor balloons floating high into the sky. Scientists estimate that 16 million tons of water, 16 million tons of water are evaporated from the earth every second. Every second. God has made provision for water, seawater, that is 800 times heavier than air. Yet he has so designed this world that 16 million tons of water are evaporated every second. Now, evaporation alone does not help the pine tree that needs water high on a mountain, 7,000 feet above sea level and several miles away. For one thing, ocean water is salty. That would kill the pine tree. Providentially, when seawater evaporates, it leaves the saline content behind. Psalm 135:7 says, he causeth the vapors to ascend from the ends of the earth. He maketh lightnings for the rain. He bringeth the wind out of his treasury. Proverbs 8 speaks of the highest part of the dust of the world. A rather strange statement at first glance. And yet those two verses explain how God gets the water from the ocean to the pine tree, high on the side of a mountain 7,000 feet above sea level, several miles away. One of the things that causes a raindrop to form, one of the necessary things, is the dust mote that the droplets can form on. Scientists tell us that about 8 million droplets are necessary to make a single drop of rain. 8 million microscopic droplets coming together around a dust mite are necessary to make a single raindrop. So what is this highest part of dust? Astronomers tell us that more than 20 million meteors reach our atmosphere every 24 hours and are burned up into dust. More than 20 million meteors a day. And so there you have as many dust motes as you need, the highest part of the dust of the world. Scientists tell us that there are as many as 6 trillion raindrops in one cloud. They tell us that each one of those raindrops is charged with electricity. That even if there is no visible lightning flash, there is always electricity when there is rain. Every time there is lightning, nitrogen is produced. The rain carries this nitrogen to the ground and washes it into the soil. It's necessary, it's vital for plants and crops and grass and trees and gardens. So in Psalm 135:7, one verse alone, we have the vapors ascending, the evaporation that is necessary. We have the lightning which brings the rain and enriches it just like God said it would. We have one final problem. If the water evaporates upward and then surrounds a speck of dust to eventually form a raindrop to rain back down, all we have is raindrops falling on the ocean. Listen to the final part of verse 7. He bringeth the wind out of his treasury. And the cycle is complete. The water evaporates from the ocean, leaving the salt behind. Dust motes are created every day for raindrops to form upon. Wind carries that moisture many miles from where it first evaporated. Lightning enriches the raindrops and sends them earthward, watering the pine tree at 7,000 feet above sea level. We just take it for granted. It's always been that way. It's always happened. We think nothing of it. And yet in that one little act of weather, divine plan, creative genius has gone into it. More than we'll ever realize in our lifetime. The Bible mentions all those necessary ingredients. And it was written a long time before scientists discovered those truths. Do you still think it was written by man, just by man, and not inspired by God? No, it couldn't be. It couldn't be. Scientists estimate, once again, 16 million tons evaporate every second, and likewise, some 16 million tons fall to the earth every second in rain and snow and hail. Most of that water falls softly and gently to the earth. Were it not so, every rain cloud could be an object of terror. The clouds reached a certain saturation point and then were rent by the weight of the moisture they contained. Great floods and streams of water falling from the sky would bring about mass destruction and death. And yet Job 26:8 says, he bindeth up the waters in his thick clouds. The cloud is not rent under them. God planned it that way. It's not just the rain that is miraculous. Consider also the snow. A snowflake is 24 times lighter than a raindrop. A snowflake is made of tiny, thousands of tiny ice crystals. There are many different categories of snowflakes. There are some called prisms and some called dendrites and some called plates, or different forms of snowflakes. All of them are six-sided. You are familiar undoubtedly with the fact that no two snowflakes are exactly alike. But have you ever really thought about that? Untold trillions upon trillions of snowflakes, all of them different. No two exactly alike. Trillions of trillions of trillions of snowflakes, all of them different. Perhaps that's why Job 38:22 asks, "Hast thou entered into the treasures of the snow?" Have you considered the treasures of the snow and the great God that made this world? Takes a little speck of dust or pollution for a snowflake to form as well. When cold water vapor bumps into an even colder speck of dust, condensation takes place. Moisture comes out of the water vapor gas and forms around the little speck. Water vapor condenses when it is chilled just a little bit below its own temperature. The piece or speck of cold dust does the chilling, causing the condensation. Instantly, the moisture freezes around the little speck of dust or pollution, and an ice crystal is formed. A tiny little baby snowflake is formed, if you will. But it cannot get to the earth just yet. It's not heavy enough. It needs to grow. Before man will see it fall to the earth as a snowflake, it will need to pick up nearly 1 quintillion water molecules. That's a 1 with 18 zeros. We'll need to pick up 1 quintillion water molecules to form into just one snowflake. Just think of what it takes to make just one snowflake. And yet a trillion of them can fall in just a short amount of time, all of them different. You realize how great God is. Every single one of those trillions of snowflakes, made up of quintillions of water molecules, every one of them different. Snow is not just for beauty. Snow provides a warm blanket for the earth where winters are severe. The snow settles into a compact layer and prevents the internal heat of the earth from escaping, so that when spring comes again, life can bloom again. Also, the mountains of snow piled high on the ranges provide an incredible reservoir of water during the heat of summer. They melt and thus give life-giving fluids to the plains below. Rain and snow also bring down minerals and nutrients, valuable nitrates of inestimable value that flow down from the mountains. The atmosphere is something we don't usually give much thought to, and yet we find that it is perfectly suited to maintain life. The air pressure must fall once again within narrow parameters. There are so many parameters of life that must remain constant. There's a very narrow gauge that they can fall within, and we talked about that a couple of years ago in a message I did, but there are so many areas that life has to be just so for life to go on. And this is another area. Two factors determine the air pressure: the weight of the gases composing the atmosphere and the height to which the air goes. A slight change in either of those could result in greatly increased or decreased pressure, making life on earth impossible. Yet Job tells us that God gives weight to the wind. The science has learned this once again only recently. But air has weight. The humidity of the atmosphere is very important. Without water vapor in the atmosphere, our conditions would become a lot more like the moon, with wildly varying temperatures between day and night. The atmosphere is necessary to diffuse the light of the sun's rays, the blues of the heavens and the glories of the sunset and the sunrises we owe to the atmosphere. Without the atmosphere, the sky would be as black as ebony, and out of which the sun would shine as a red-hot ball. Its beams would reveal only those objects upon which they directly fell or on which they were reflected. At the close of the day, the sun would suddenly plunge out of view, leaving us in utter darkness. There are so many things that we take for granted and don't even think about. And yet a master designer has brilliantly engineered every area down to the minutest detail. You can choose to believe it all happened by chance if you want. But the Bible says you're a fool if you do. I say that not to offend you, but to let you know where you stand in the eyes of God. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. The fool can look around him and think it all just happened, just accidentally came into being. The fool can look at the snowflake and look at the stars and look at a tree and say, it just evolved, it just happened. If you believe that it all just happened, God says you're a fool. If you don't believe in God, you say, what do you believe in then? Surely not evolution. It's not hard to disprove evolution. There are hundreds of questions that evolutionists can't answer. No, you'll need to come up with something else. If you don't believe in God, evolution cannot satisfy. It's not intellectually sound or scientifically correct. On what then will you base your life? On what then will you base your eternity? Why is there placed within man a vacuum that only a relationship with God can fill? If there is no God, why have you found that you cannot fill that vacuum within you with anything? It always empties out. Oh, man tries everything today. Alcohol, drugs, immorality, thrills and chills, excitement, money, things, adventure, recreation. But he always finds that vacuum is empty again. And he needs something. Constantly searching. Constantly empty. Because only God can fill that vacuum. Mark Twain had a lot of wit and tremendous literary skill. But he didn't have God. He lived his life without him. Mark Twain was a pen name for Samuel Langhorne Clemens. A man possessed of tremendous wit. Tremendous humor. You would think he would have been fulfilled. With his fame and the opportunities that fame afforded him, surely that man would be fulfilled. Surely that man would not have a vacuum. No, only God can fill that vacuum. And that's why Mark Twain in his autobiography wrote this. A myriad of men are born. They labor and struggle and sweat for bread. They squabble and scold and fight. They scramble for little mean advantages over each other. Age creeps upon them and infirmities follow. Shame and humiliation bring down their pride and vanities. Those they love are taken from them and the joy of life is turned to aching grief. The burden of pain, care, misery grows heavier year by year. At length, ambition is dead. Longing for relief is in its place. It comes at last. The only unpoisoned gift earth has for them. And they vanish from a world where they were of no consequence, where they achieved nothing, where they were a mistake and a failure and a foolishness, where they left no sign that they had ever existed, a world that will lament them a day and forget them forever. Of life, he said, life is all a dream, a grotesque and foolish dream. Well, my friend, this morning, life without God is empty. It does not matter what you try to put within your bosom. If you do not have God, you're empty. Oh, I'm not talking about a religious knowledge of God. I'm talking about a personal relationship with Him. If you do not have God, you're empty.